The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning, and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning we are as close to you as your home. We are a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. I'm Preston Lutweiler, treasurer of our Board of Trustees, and I want to personally welcome you this morning. Wherever you are in your life journey, wherever you are in your spiritual journey, whomever you love, whatever your gender identity or expression, we welcome you into our ever-expanding circle of compassion and caring. If you are visiting us today, you will notice in the Zoom chat a link to our virtual visitor card. This is a way for you to connect with us and us with you. Please fill it out at any time during the service. Our service today will be about two of our UU principles. Our seventh UU principle calls on us to affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence. And most of us are proudly all about ecology and environmental protection. At the same time, our second principle is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And most of us are equally proud of our UU heritage in this area. But have we always been faithful to both principles? Rich Wallace will present us with a confounding contradiction. The history of natural resource conservation and environmental protection is riddled with racism. The contradiction undermines goals of both justice and conservation. We are on the threshold today, or perhaps the precipice, of both an opportunity and an urgent imperative to correct our course and set a path for the future in which both goals may be met. Now, Becky Douglas will prepare us for lighting the chalice with words from Rachel Carlson. Becky?
We stand now where two roads diverge, but unlike the roads in Robert Frost's familiar poem, they are not equally fair. The road we have long been traveling is deceptively easy, a smooth superhighway on which we progress with great speed, but at its end lies disaster. The other fork of the road, the one less traveled by, offers our last, our only chance to reach a destination that assures the preservation of the earth. Those who dwell among the beauties and mysteries of the earth are never alone or weary of life. Those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts. The more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and realities of the universe, the less taste we shall have for destruction.
And now I will light the peace lamp. After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us and with all the people of the world. And now we will have our gathering song, hymn number 203, All Creatures of the Earth and Sky. The attributions are in the order of service, and the words will appear on the screen for you to sing along.
Lift your voices high. Alleluia, alleluia.
We have come to the part of our service that we sometimes call a moment for all ages, and sometimes conversation through story. I'd like to present something a little different, thoughts from several ages of history intended for a variety of ages of listeners. For more than 10,000 years, the indigenous people who lived on the continent that we call home worshiped, respected, and lived in harmony with nature. Those concepts were not invented by transcendentalists in the 19th century, nor by environmental activists in the 1960s. Yet on November 16, 1857, Henry David Thoreau famously wrote, quote, "It is not enough to be industrious. So are the ants. The question is, what are we industrious about?" In that same year, 1857, another author made a different observation about the human condition. Frederick Douglass wrote, quote, "Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle." A century later, both the struggle for freedom and justice and the question of what we should be industrious about remained. Rachel Carson wrote, "The question is whether any civilization can wage relentless war on life without destroying itself and without losing the right to be called civilized." Around that same time, another author, Dr. Seuss, whom we like to claim as a UU, but he never really joined a fellowship, wrote a little book about a man named Wunsler, who chopped down truffula trees and built factories to make needs, and about the Lorax, who tried to speak for the trees. When the last truffula tree was felled, there were no more trees, no more needs, no more work to be done, leaving only Wunsler, his big empty factory, and the Lorax. The Lorax said nothing and disappeared, leaving a small pile of rocks with one word, "unless." What that meant, Wunsler thought, he couldn't guess. But later, Wunsler says, "Speaking to you, the word of the Lorax seems perfectly clear. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not." So, "Catch," calls the Wunsler. He lets something fall. It's a truffula seed. It's the last one of all. You're in charge of the last of the truffula seeds. And truffula trees are what everyone needs. Plant a new truffula, treat it with care, give it clean water and feed it fresh air. Grow a forest, protect it from axes that hack. Then the Lorax and all of his friends may come back. The damage that has been done and is being done to our natural environment by our relentless industriousness urgently calls us to honor the example of indigenous peoples and to heed the words of Thoreau, Carson, and the Lorax that call us to live by our seventh principle. At the same time, the words of Frederick Douglass call us to do so, accepting the struggle to live by our second principle. And now for our musical meditation, we will play a video of hymn number 121, "We'll Build a Land." The attributions are in the order of service. We often sing along with this hymn, and you can do that. The words are shown in the video. However, today I'm suggesting that you watch and listen and take in the melody, the images, and the words. Our Soul Matters theme for the month of April is becoming, and this hymn paints a picture of a community and a world we can strive to become. Thank you.
peace, where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream. We'll build a land building up ancient cities, raising up devastations from mold, restoring ruins of generations. Oh, we'll build a land of people so bold. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, anointed by God, may then create peace, where justice shall sound from spirits once faint and once weak, where like oaks of righteousness stand her people. Oh, come build the land my people we seek. Come build the land where sisters and brothers, anointed by God,
Wendell Berry is an American novelist, poet, essayist, environmental activist, cultural critic, and farmer. He was a writer and editor for Rodale Press. And in 2003, he wrote the poem, The Peace of Wild Things. The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night, at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water. I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free. And now, Rich Wallace will give our sermon on an opportunity to marry ecology and justice. Rich was founding chair of the Studies Department at Ursinus College, and today he is a senior staff member of the Ecological Society of America, where he is and Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment, a premier environmental science journal. Rich?
Thank you so much, Preston. Let me just ask for a thumbs up that everyone can hear me okay. One thumbs, thank you very much. So it's such a pleasure to be here with you this morning. I know some of you, and some of you know me, and we go back a ways. For about 8 years, I was a regular member of Thomas Paine. My wife Shannon and I were, and our kids, and we raised our kids there. And I don't get back often enough with you in community, and I'm very glad to be back. And I only wish that we were together physically in the sanctuary today. So I'm going to talk to you today. Actually, let me give, for those of you who don't know me, I'll just take a second to give my background. I mean, Preston gave me a brief introduction. I'm a conservation professional. In essence, I've been working on the intersection of science and society in the interest of conservation for about 40 years. I spent 10 years with government and environmental organizations helping to improve federal conservation programs. And then I spent 20 years teaching, most of it at Ursinus College here in Collegeville, about the integration of conservation science and society. And now I work for the Ecological Society of America, which is a a big nonprofit based in DC, though I still live here. And I work on global communication of conservation science to address societal problems. So this is really what I want to talk to you about today, the integration of justice and ecology, or really nature, I'll use those terms interchangeably, and how the bringing together of those two things actually causes me to feel optimistic. And because, I mean, obviously we're all in the world in trying times, it's good to share positive feelings. And so that's what I want to do with you today. Preston gave a little bit of an introduction earlier this morning, alluding to this sort of dark history of injustice and obviously environmental degradation. I'm not going to talk too much about that. I'll make some reference to that in context, but I wanted to focus really on the positive today a little bit more. Again, to make sure we're all on the same page, I'm talking mostly about the second and seventh principle. And just so that we can be grounded in that, I'm going to read. The second principle is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And the seventh principle is respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. So optimism about these principles, about justice and ecology or nature, comes in context, right? So these days, that context, especially the last 4 and some years, does not on its face often seem like reason for optimism, which is why it's worth laying out this context before we proceed. The challenges of achieving the goals of these principles of the second and seventh principle have become really just increasingly urgent over time. And this is for a host of reasons, which I won't go into all of them, but some of them are that the scale at which human behavior is impacting the integrity of nature is huge. I mean, we're all aware of climate change, right? That's sort of the iconic example. Both environmental issues and social justice have become increasingly partisan and polarized in the last generation. They form sort of an open wedge now between peoples. And this increasing polarization is exacerbated by the way communication happens these days, this sort of instant global communication that creates an incredible amount of echo chambered noise. And I'm not going to talk about that specifically, but I make that point because this doesn't just make it hard to have simple, open conversations about complex problems, which is what we need to do, but it actually dissuades people from trying to have those conversations. So I'm going to talk about how important it is to have those conversations a little bit later. So as well, social change, as we all know from our involvement or even just reading the news, social change to achieve either ecological goals, nature-oriented goals, or justice-oriented goals is really slow. Patience and tenacity is required, as are strategies that embrace the long game. And to put it in a UU context, this is true. This need for the long game is true even for in Unitarian Universalism. As you probably all know, the revised 7 UU principles were adopted in 1960 after a really long process of self-reflection, but not the 7th principle. So 1960 was 2 years before Rachel Carson, who we heard a quote from earlier. 1960 was 2 years before Rachel Carson published her seminal work, Silent Spring. So that spawned the environmental movement, as we all know, which occurred starting in the mid-60s. So it took another 25 years before UUism adopted the 7th principle. The interdependent web of life was added to the principles in 1985. See, the long game is necessary, even in this context. So one of the things that surprises people when I talk about this time horizon issue, this playing the long game, and especially surprises my students, all of whom are between 18 and 22 years old, is when I tell them that as an environmental professional, I'm working on the same issues now that I was 40 years ago. And I don't mean that like broadly or generally, I mean that too, but I mean the same exact issues. So I'll give you an example, because these are reasons for optimism. You know, my students look at me with big eyes and they say, oh my God, 40 years you've been working on the same thing, that must be terrible. And the answer is no, it's actually really empowering. So one of the things I work on is human-wildlife coexistence. So when I started out, there were no wolves in the Western United States. They'd been hunted out almost entirely throughout the United States by about the 1930s. So since the start of my career, wolves have been introduced into Yellowstone National Park and Idaho by the government, and they have naturally recolonized Montana and Washington and Oregon and California, helping to return intact ecosystems or more intact ecosystems to all those places. So it took us about 60 years without wolves, and then 25 years of really hard work to make that happen. And of course, the work isn't over if you follow wolf news, as I do, being a wolf nerd. State governments are trying once again to control and kill off wolf populations. So this battle is one that continues and probably will for a long time. So I'll mention one other success. That's been the return of marine mammals like whales and seals to the east coast of the United States. So if you spend time at the beach, either the Jersey Shore or Delaware or Maryland. So the history of this in 2 seconds, after centuries of exploitation of whales and seals and the like, we protected all marine mammals in the United States in 1972. So when I started my career, seeing a seal on the east coast of the United States was rare. Mostly they were in Canadian waters and northern New England. So now seals haul out everywhere up and down to the mid-Atlantic. We've got seals hauling out on the beaches of Delaware as the populations grow and extend southwards. So there are so many more whales of certain species that there are now whale watching tours out of New York Harbor. So I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. So you couldn't go whale watching in New York when I was growing up, but you can now with a very good likelihood of seeing whales. So this is all progress, but it takes a long time. And it doesn't just happen. So the length of time it takes to reach these goals and the dedication it takes to ensure that they're not later lost can be a hard reality if you're not prepared for it. But if you are prepared, it can be empowering. Spending a long time working on something, for one thing, makes you good at it, makes it part of you. And keeping your eyes on the prize is motivating. But it requires a certain perspective of time. So how do we stay optimistic over those long periods of time? So what I tell my students, frankly, and my friends and my family and anyone else who will listen, and I've got you now as a captive audience, is that in the face of these challenges, there's just so much to appreciate and to be hopeful for. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, take a look outside. So if we were together in the sanctuary at Thomas Paine, I would have us all look towards the windows, the bank of windows and doors, right? And one of my favorite things about the sanctuary, especially this time of year, is the woods that line that side of the property. And if we had the doors open here in April, we'd hear the morning chorus of birds actively engaged in nesting and courtship behavior, literally making life in spirit and action. Spring is such a hopeful metaphor. There's great hope in the resilience and perseverance of nature and ecology, and it's just outside our windows. So I don't know where you are now specifically. I'm in my home office in Collegeville, just a few minutes from Thomas Paine. But when you have the chance, take a look outside, listen to the interdependent web of life happening around you. There's so much beauty and so much life to cherish, and it needs us. And then ask yourself, what is it about it that you love? And maybe extend beyond where you are. Where are your favorite places in nature? What is it about them that you love? Why are they important to you? And then take it a little further. What do you do to ensure that they are cared for as you would like them to be, that they will be protected for future generations? So we'll get back to that. So I'm talking mostly about nature so far. Integrating justice and ecology starts with us as individuals. It starts with, and this is sort of the nature reflection that I've just mentioned is a bit of a teaser, right? Because integrating justice and ecology is hard work, and it starts with self-reflection, placing ourselves in the context of the challenges that we face. This means developing a more precise understanding of what it is that we care about. This isn't a stretch for most UUs, from my experience, where we're well-read, caring, interested in the details. And we already agree on a set of principles that not only brings us together, but which are designed to strengthen the world in which we live. We all have times that we've selflessly dedicated ourselves to the betterment of others. You know how good it feels to be part of something that is bigger than yourself. So that's the context in which I place myself, my students, my colleagues, my friends, when we talk about the challenges we face. Be aware of the beauty and diversity of nature around us. Be self-aware and in touch with your values. But the question is not just what we can do to make ourselves feel better, or even what we can do to protect nature, but rather what we are willing to do to make the world more just and sustainable and livable for everyone for all species, now and in the future. This is the integration of justice and ecology. So I want to share some strategies with you. The first and probably most important is to develop language to talk about the things we care about with whoever we can. That's about being ready to speak up for your values. We all do this. This is part of being UU. So this means, for example, turning the second and seventh principles into action, into the willingness to advocate for your values. And we've got a principle for that too, the fifth principle, which is the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. This is the social action principle. So here's what it means to me. We want people who share our values to be in positions of power, right? But more personally, more directly, we should want people in power to help us feel empowered. Do your interactions with your leaders about nature or about justice leave you feeling empowered? It's a question we should all ask ourselves. So right now we are in the first 100 days of the Biden administration. April 30th actually will be the 100th day. Before you get worried that I'm going to go off on a partisan political rant, I'm not. As I'll explain in a minute, it's the ability and desire to work with anyone, regardless of their political persuasion, that allows us the freedom to succeed. I want to talk about the Biden administration for a minute because that's who's president now. Remember, one critical piece to being in the world, to living the principles, is to embrace the context that makes them real. That may sound esoteric, but it's not. To talk about justice and nature requires us to talk about politics, just as it requires us to talk about race. We have to have the hard conversations. And right now, thanks to who happens to be president, we have reasons to think of justice and ecology and be optimistic. So last year, I was an environmental advisor to the Biden campaign. There were a lot of us, and we had a very specific charge to propose the issues we believed that the campaign needed to address. But the campaign was very clear with us. Everything needed to be seen through the lens of justice. Everything environmental needed to be seen through the lens of justice. That charge itself was a departure from past approaches to environmental protection, which much more often have been splintered from concerns of justice. Our history of environmental protection has suffered from this fragmentation, as conservation and environmental protection in the US has often come at the expense of justice, disadvantaging people to protect land, starting with the Native Americans, selectively enforcing pollution and agricultural laws on the basis of race to disadvantage people of color, and on and on. So when I heard the Biden campaign's pronouncement that all environmental issues must also address justice, I wondered, that's good, but is it just words? Well, here are some of my reasons for optimism. At the top of my list are two newly confirmed US presidential cabinet members, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland and Environmental Protection Agency EPA Administrator Michael Reagan. Haaland of New Mexico is a member of the Laguna Pueblo people and the highest ranking Native American government official in US history. Her formal responsibilities include acting as the government's leading voice on Native American affairs and managing more than 400 million acres of public land. Imagine a Native American woman responsible for our government's Native American affairs. No Native American man or woman has ever been in that position before. Nor has a Native American woman's sensitivity ever been brought to the concerns of public land leadership, especially in the Western United States, which has long been the province of powerful white men. I'm also optimistic about EPA Administrator Michael Reagan, who hails from a majority Black town in East Central North Carolina. He's the first Black man and the second person of color to lead the EPA. Soon after his confirmation, Reagan issued a much needed agency-wide order officially assigning to every EPA region, office, and program responsibility for integrating environmental justice into all of their existing responsibilities. That's a start, but not an isolated initiative, nor rhetoric alone. Last month, I had the pleasure of attending the first ever public meeting of the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council. The council's charge includes, this is a government body, and its charge includes working with state, tribal, and local governments and local communities nationwide. At that first meeting, I witnessed council members, other environmental professionals, and members of the public, people from a dizzying array of racial, cultural, and geographic backgrounds passionately express their shared goals. Those goals, when translated into policies and programs, will advance the integration of justice, environmental protection, and science further than at any time in US history. There's more. In December, Congressman David Scott of Georgia became the first Black chair of the Agriculture Committee of the US House of Representatives. Then in March, that committee for the first time asked Black farmers to give testimony of their experiences of decades of systematic discrimination by the US Department of Agriculture. That's part of a much needed reckoning on racial discrimination in government environmental policy. That has never occurred before. Addressing rampant and systemic inequities in policy implementation requires both leadership and a massive influx of resources. In its April budget request to the US Congress, the Biden administration included more than $1.4 billion for environmental justice programs across all environmental and natural resource agencies. That's not enough, but it's a start. And it's important to recognize that presidential budget requests are only wish lists. The US Congress sets and allocates the federal budget. But the Biden administration has laid down a marker of sorts, identifying and highlighting the attention needed to rectify decades of injustice in environmental policy. All of this is reason for optimism. But what does it mean for us? It gets us back to the issue of empowerment. To move these goals forward, we need to get to know our elected officials, particularly at this moment in time, the ones responsible for the budget. And I don't worry about their political persuasion, and you shouldn't either. I try to think of people as individuals first. I've lived in Collegeville for 20 years. So just as an example, it was important to me to get to know my members of Congress, Jim Gerlach at first, Ryan Costello, and now Madeline Dean. Getting to know Jim Gerlach 20 years ago led to his being comfortable participating in a climate change forum that I helped to organize on Edersinus College. That was a topic Gerlach, frankly, knew nothing about, but he was willing to discuss in a public setting with leading scientists, that is, people much more experienced than him. That took some courage on his part. I became friendly with Ryan Costello, which led to him asking me to help him learn about the environmental issues that I cared about, which led to him helping me achieve policy advocacy goals in Congress in a real way. Madeline Dean, of course, takes no convincing on the environment or social justice, and so I got to know her and her legislative staff and communicate directly with them when I need to. Mad became a regular visitor to Ursinus, coming whenever I asked her and helping my students learn to see these challenging issues in a positive, productive light. That's her way. So getting to know our elected officials, it's an interpersonal social interaction more than a political one, and we can all do it. It's a direct representation of the fifth principle and a direct route to action on the second and seventh principles. So in closing, some questions to bring together the themes that I've been addressing. How well do you know your local nature and natural history? What's important to you to maintain or protect? Where are your favorite places, your favorite things to see or experience in nature? How do your elected officials feel about the places and issues that you care about in your heart? How do they understand the complexity of integrating nature and justice? Do you know? Have you asked them? And not just our federal legislators. How does your planning commission feel, your borough council or township commission? How are you empowering yourself? And are you helping others to feel empowered? And are you helping others to help you feel empowered? It's a big circle, right? Making all these shared connections is called creating community. That's what we're doing here, right? What I've talked with you about this morning is how I connect myself to the principles and then to the people around me and to the wider world. I know that you do that too. That's Unitarian Universalism. That's who we are. And I think that I'll stop there, but thank you so much for having me today. And it's a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. And now we have come to the time in our service for matters of the heart. After a brief musical interlude, you may raise your virtual hand on Zoom and share a brief message, one or two sentences, about a joy that may be lifting you up or a sorrow that may be weighing you down. Or you may type a message into chat. I'll read the messages in chat after everyone who wishes to speak has spoken. Thank you. So I think we're ready to move on to singing our sung response song, Spirit of Life. The words will appear in the video on the screen, and then I will give the closing words and pass it off to Becky for extinguishing the chalice. And now I invite you all to read along with me the words of Theodore Parker, Be Ours a Religion. The words will appear on the next slide. Be ours a religion, which like sunshine goes everywhere, its temple all space, its shrine the good heart, its creed all truth, its ritual works of love, its profession of faith, divine living. And Becky Douglas will read our closing words while I extinguish the chalice.
As we go forth from the sacred space, may we celebrate Earth and our shared lives. May we recognize our connections to all that is in and on Earth. May we truly and deeply value the inherent worth of all. In this awesome interconnected web of existence, may we commit ourselves to a new way, and may we hold our commitments and each other gently yet firmly. We extinguish the flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we gather again. Now we'll have our closing song, Blue Boat Home by Peter Mayer.
Standing on these mountains and plains, far away from the rolling ocean, still my dry land heart can say, I've been sailing all my life now, never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home. Sun, my sail, and moon, my rudder, as I ply the starry sea, leaning over the edge in one, casting questions into the deep, drifting here with my ship's companions, all we kindred pilgrim souls, making our way by the lights of the heavens in our beautiful blue boat home. Thanks to the waves upholding me, hail the great winds urging me on. Greet the infinite sea before me, sing the sky my sailor's song. I was born upon the fathoms, never harbor or port have I known. Wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home.